I even had a vision during that pregnancy of Jesus holding my baby in heaven, like protecting the baby. So I knew like God cared. I knew like Jesus was real and his promises were real. I did not understand it. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Ollick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, hey, everybody, it's so good to be with you today. We are off for another exciting conversation on Made to Advance. And listen, I know some of you have just listened to us for a very short amount of time. This may be your first episode today. Others of you have been with us a long time. I'm going to ask you a favor, though. No matter how long you've listened, could you actually hit pause right now and rate and review us? That is a massive help to the podcast, and I know it's an incredible encouragement to our team. And while I say that, we have an email now for Made to Advance. It's mta@engedichurch.com, mta@engedichurch.com. And we would love to hear your feedback. If you've got ideas, if you've got notes of appreciation, you name it, send it to us. And I know myself and our team will be really encouraged. We read every email that comes in. And so we welcome yours. But today we've got a really great guest on. Jess Ronnie is with me. She is the executive director of the Lucas Project, which is a nonprofit dedicated to supporting special needs families. Jess also hosts the podcast Coffee with Caregivers and has written several really encouraging books. Jess has shared her family story on multiple national news outlets, and we are so honored to have her with us today. Jess, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you made it in through a blizzard day. I mean, we've got crazy amounts of snow that have been dumped on, and I was thinking of you, and it's good you clarified this because I was thinking about 8 kids at home, but now you clarified mm-hmm. you only have 4 at home. Mm-hmm. But is it like when you guys have this, because we've been, how many days has school been closed?
Forever.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Today's
Thursday.
Is it this fourth?
Yeah, because it was Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Monday.
Oh, that's right.
So yeah, we are on 4 days of no school.
So like for some folks, it's like, oh, this is the best. We're all hanging out and all that. What's it like for you?
That's not my reality. No. I'm like, I have to work.
Yeah.
Get your own lunch. Yeah. I will check in on you. No, we're on day 4 of Minecraft.
Okay.
Forever and ever. of here's your chore list. You have to do your chores.
Yeah.
Please clean your dishes after you eat lunch.
Yeah.
But yeah, I work full time, so and I work from home. So
yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, the working from home full time with kids is a heck of a combination. How old are your kids at home right now?
17, 15, 15, and 9.
Okay, gotcha. So they're mostly pretty
they
capable.
Are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although it's funny, like I left today and I gave my son explicit instructions. The whole broader driveway is shoveled, and then the sidewalks, all that. But there's one little like cutaway spot off the side of the driveway where he parks that's paved.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't shoveled. And so I see him out there ready, getting to pull away. And of course, instead of shoveling around his car, it's, you know, maybe 2 feet of snow, like widthwise and whatever we got in inches.
Right.
Of course, instead of shoveling, my man just drives over it, pulls up. He's about to brush all the snow off of his car on the part of the driveway that had already been cleared. And so then I say, no, hey, if you're going to do that, you need to shovel all that snow off. And then, by the way, go shovel your little spot over there.
Right.
So when I leave the house, he's already gone. I look at his spot. He shoveled in the front part of his car, like where he has to kind of pull out to get into the, you know, get out of a spot. But he leaves this huge pile in the back. And I text him and I'm like, Evan, how come there's a huge pile of snow in the back? And he goes, well, I don't need to drive over that part to get into my spot. So I just left it.
Hmm.
And I texted him back and I'm like, are you yanking my chain? Or did you really think when Dad said shovel out your spot, that meant just every spot your wheels touch.
Try again.
Parenting, you know? So even when they're 18, you're still like having some fun.
Yeah. I mean, I have an 18-year-old daughter too, driving around on a car she should not be driving in.
Yeah.
But she is, and it's not safe
yeah.
because she has to get out and see her friends.
Yeah, right. Well, I'd love for everybody to hear your story today. I'm super glad and been looking that you're here and been looking forward to this conversation. I want to kind of rewind all the way back towards the front end of your journey. And so you'll have to correct me. I think I've got all my dates right. But in 2004, mm-hmm. you and your husband had one child. You find out you're pregnant with Lucas. Mm-hmm. And then during that time, you get some pretty surprising news about the pregnancy. And so share with us what that news was.
Yeah, that was the moment that really changed the whole trajectory of my life. Was 2004. I went to what I thought was a routine ultrasound appointment, mm-hmm. and it was there that we were told that our baby had experienced a stroke in utero and there was no hope. The doctor specifically said, you should terminate. You're young and healthy. You won't have any problems getting pregnant again. These babies just aren't supposed to make it.
Wow.
And I went home, my husband and I prayed about it. We knew that termination was not an option, and instead just placed the baby in the Lord's hands. And that just became a four-month intense battle in my own spirit, just begging God to heal my baby. Mm-hmm. And even going so far as to say, you know, I can't handle a profoundly disabled child. So if that's your will, heal this baby in heaven. And 4 months later, Lucas was born, came out screaming with life on mm-hmm. August 12, 2004. And I just wept in relief. I was shocked that I had my miracle baby. And after spending 2 weeks in the NICU undergoing brain surgery, Jason and I were handed our baby with a stack of papers with sort of this umbrella diagnosis of special needs. And we were told good luck. And wow. We went home and just honestly didn't even think of myself as a special needs mom. I was just elated to be mom to this miracle baby that I thought I would be bearing, honestly.
Did you, what, if you don't mind me pressing in a little bit on what was the nature of your conviction that from the jump you were saying termination is not an option?
I think it, you know, I was raised in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. It's part of my whole background and upbringing and everything we learn about termination and, mm-hmm. you know, life is the sanctity of life and every life is valued. And I just didn't feel like it was my responsibility to make life or death decisions. If God called me to be obedient and carry this child, whatever that looked like, whatever the outcome, it was just my job to be obedient mm-hmm. to what he asked me to do. Wow. And so, yeah, that was what that looked like then, was carrying a baby that was basically pronounced dead mm-hmm. Before he even arrived.
To what extent did you know what you were going to be dealing with ahead of birth? Like, based on what they knew about Lucas's journey and what they could tell you, I mean, was it pretty, this is exactly what's going to happen if he lives, or was it just, we'll have to see? I mean, what did you expect if he survived?
There were no expectations. Nobody had any answers. There were children who had severe hydrocephalus who had a shunt put in and became like completely typical, normal functioning children. Mm. There were children like Lucas who had hydrocephalus at birth, had a shunt put in, and had numerous diagnoses for the rest of their life. I was just completely believing in faith. That's not going to be my scenario. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have, you know, my faith is going to create this perfect scenario that I want.
Yeah.
And that became part of the whole journey too, was God getting me to this point of complete surrender to what his will was, not what my will was.
Wow. So when then Lucas is born, explain to me the nature of, and I know obviously as a baby, you probably don't have a full grasp around what the level of disability is going to be and how that's going to play out over time, but what did you discover about the nature of his disabilities? And maybe you start with when he was born, but then also just kind of as he became a toddler and such, mm-hmm. what did you learn about what the situation was?
He was extremely challenging. He had a 2-year-old size head at birth.
Okay.
And so his muscle tone and his neck could not support his own head. So we had numerous instances, even when he would like lower his head and we'd have to lift it back up or he would have suffocated himself.
Wow.
And so just imagine that even all through the night as a new parent. And if he could have somehow flipped himself over, he could not have had the strength to put him, like lift his head to mm-hmm. be able to breathe. And so I hardly ever slept. He hardly slept. He was delayed in every aspect of life, nonverbal. He remains primarily nonverbal to this day. He has maybe 20 or 30 words.
How old is he today?
He's 20.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And, you know, those first couple of years, we just literally held on for dear life. And then probably around 3 years old, we kind of got into a groove where it was like, okay, he's sleeping. We got a safety bed. That was a game changer.
What's a safety bed?
It's like this huge padded bed. It's like a crib forever.
Okay.
Just like a queen size bed with 6 foot walls that are padded all the way around.
Wow.
And we started giving him melatonin. So he started at least sleeping 4 or 5 hours a stretch. Mm-hmm. And we like sort of settled into our new life, and found out we were pregnant again when Lucas was around, 3 years old.
Okay.
And had our daughter, in 2007.
What was it like, on the one hand, caring for a special needs child and then going back to like, now we're raising a newborn as well? I mean, that's just a wild thought by itself. I could see where some, I don't know, you've got a lot of obviously experience with families who are raising special needs kids.
Mm-hmm.
Do many people, after they have a special needs child, say, hey, I think we're going to take a break from having more kids because this is a lot. That does happen a lot.
Oh, yeah, a lot. I've had a lot of people say, I can't believe you went on to have 3 more kids after Lucas.
And well, I'm joining that. Oh, okay. Yeah, that just is like, wow.
But I had this vision in my heart, and it was like a 4 kids, and it was 3 boys and 1 girl, and I'm very type A, and like this is what we need to do.
Yeah.
And every pregnancy after that was extremely stressful. Just wondering, you know, would this baby be typical? Would they be all right? Were there going to be problems? But I'm glad, you know, I leapt in faith. I have, you know, 3 more beautiful children because we decided to go for it.
Did the kids, as Lucas, as they're all growing up, but as Lucas is growing up and everybody's, I mean, he changes too with growing up, just like all of us do. Did they adjust to kind of being part of the team Lucas early on, or was that a hard thing to navigate Lucas and some of the different kind of challenges or whatever? I don't know if that's the best word. How did the kids respond as they were getting older?
I think we've all always kind of rallied around Lucas because he needed more help.
Mm-hmm.
And even Caleb, my oldest, he was 2 when Lucas was born, and it's just always been a part of his reality. It's just his brother. And, you know, he went on to have 6 more typical siblings. That's further on down the story.
Yeah,
but I can see how there could be a lot of focus on the special needs, on the disability, if that's 1 or 2 children, I think. But when you have 8, and so you have the blessing and the opportunity to see so many other children also, you know, stepping into their roles and their purpose in life, I think Luke was always just Luke. And we all tried to assist him in whatever ways he needed assistance.
What was it's tough because for those of us who haven't had a special needs family member, we don't know what that day-to-day looks like. And obviously, it varies upon what any given person is dealing with, and even the season of life they're in. When you describe, so the bed example is a good example of trying to give us a picture of what it's like, but what is it like? I mean, what is daily life like that would be different? And I guess you'll just have to pick however you want to approach that from an age perspective, because I know you've talked about what it was like to when he went like through puberty, and that was its whole own deal. So I don't even know how to answer or like ask the question, because do you pick, you know, when he's a toddler? Do you pick teens? What do you do?
Right.
So just take it where you want to go as far as, I guess what I, and the reason why I'm asking is I want to help our listeners just understand and feel a reality that many of us have never experienced up close.
Thank you for asking that, first of all. And we created a documentary to address that.
Which is called Unseen. Yeah,
Unseen.
Maybe you want to speak to that too.
Unseen, how we're failing parent caregivers and why it matters.
Yeah.
And that was born out of Lucas going through puberty. Lucas has always been very challenging. He is nonverbal, numerous diagnoses. He needs assistance in every aspect of life, bathing, feeding. He's in diapers. As he went through puberty, I say he like outgrew cute, really, because even up until then, we were able to get help, because even a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old in diapers, that's not such a big deal. You can still find a babysitter. You know, they're cute and they're lovable and totally dependent on you. But when you have a 13, 14, 15-year-old who's screaming at you, who's lashing out at siblings, who cannot explain what his needs are, who's incontinent, who still needs help getting into the bathtub, and he's getting bigger and he's getting stronger, and you feel like your back is breaking because you're also getting older and weaker, that's when I often say I never grieved the fact that I had a special needs child until Lucas started to go through puberty. And that's when it hit me, like, this is a forever gig. And I will be doing this well into my old age. This is me sacrificing retirement. It's sacrificing travel with my husband. It's, I mean, up until then, it was sacrificing girls' nights out because I can't leave my husband home with Lucas after he works all day and 7 other children. So it was just a lot of sacrificing for many, many years. And even the divide and conquer, like with the other kids, it was always one of us attending games or activities or church things.
Right.
And one of us staying home with Lucas because the world just isn't created for an individual like him.
Once you got into a rhythm as a family of this is what it's like to do life with Lucas, did you find yourself having many grieving moments where it's you and God and saying, oh God, I can't do this? Or was it more like once you find a rhythm, you kind of just most of the time are doing your thing and it doesn't, you don't feel all the weight of this is how hard this is? Yeah.
I think I've had some time to process this over this past year, because Lucas moved into a group home, and I've gone deep in like what was in me to make me continue to create resources. And I think what I've discovered about myself is that when you're living in that constant survival mode, you're like either fighting or flighting or fawning or fleeing. And my go-to reaction is to fight. So I see something, I see an obstacle, and how are we going to fix this? And that's what led to the nonprofit and creating respite. It's what led to the group home. It's what led to everything that I've accomplished in life. Like, how are we going to bring awareness and try to fix this problem? For our family, Lucas was always that thread, but then it trickled out into the rest of the world as well, bringing that awareness and the supports and the resources and the respite. I don't know that everybody necessarily ticks like that.
Yeah.
And I've learned that about myself. I'm a problem solver. I don't see problems and think there isn't a solution. It's like, okay, we just don't see the solution yet, but how are we going to get to the solution? Yeah.
It sounds like because your wiring is what it is, like let's get after it. Let's make a difference. Let's solve this. Let's figure out a better way. You're probably just by personality, not doing a lot of sitting there thinking, oh, woe is me and all that. You're like, let's get after this. How early on, I mean, now with whether it be the Lucas Project or the documentary or books you've written, the podcast, all these different things, how early on did you start sensing a calling to say, hey, this is more than just about our family trying to make it happen, and we need to do something that's bigger for other families experiencing similar dynamics?
I think I had that vision planted in me the day Lucas was born, because I remember being in the hospital with him and promising him to one day start a nonprofit in his honor, always thinking the nonprofit would help the children. And then when we were floundering so much and my husband ended up in ER with panic attacks that resembled heart attacks, and I'm wondering if I'm going to lose another husband, which we haven't gotten to that part of the story yet.
Right.
But that's when I realized, you know, the child is only as healthy as the caregivers. And if we don't provide some support and some resources for these families, the child is never going to be healthy either. So it was a vision the Lord planted in me from very early on, but it didn't really come to fruition until years later.
How old was Lucas when the Lucas Project started?
About 15.
Okay, yeah. So you really had to sit and for a sustained amount of time, just be a mom.
Yeah.
And then you're probably praying, germinating, dreaming someday, and those kinds of things, but waited quite a while.
Yeah, it was like kind of on the bucket list.
Yeah.
Like, someday I'd like to create this nonprofit.
Yeah, I really love that, though, because I think a lot of times what happens when people have different kinds of dreams and visions that God puts in their heart is if enough time elapses, they end up concluding, you know what, maybe this just isn't to be, or, you know, just kind of gets backburnered, forgotten, whatever. And so it's a good encouragement to any of us who God's put something in our heart. It could be 15 years old. It could be 30 years old.
Oh, yeah.
But there was something in there that that God was saying, hey, this is something I want you to take some steps with, and there's still time. There's still time. Like, take action on it. I love that. I am curious on the documentary, how did that, was that like your brainchild, or was that somebody else's, or how did that whole thing happen? I mean, it's a major film. It's an awesome project. How did that happen?
That's kind of a funny story. That was just a great idea. my family jokes, my tombstone will say, Jess had a great idea and some not so great ideas.
Yeah.
No, I just thought we need to create a documentary to showcase to the world, like, what our families go through. And so I hopped on Facebook and just did a Facebook post. Hey, I have this great idea.
Yeah.
If there's a filmmaker or producer anywhere that would want to get together for lunch, I would love to discuss it with you. And there was a filmmaker in Nashville, and his wife was a producer, and they saw my post and they reached out and we got lunch. And 4 years later, we created this documentary. They followed our family around for 4 years.
That's how long they've, Well, it's funny. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I look forward to doing so. But when you look at the website for it and whatnot, I mean, there's a lot of big organizations. And I mean, this is not like a little mom and pop project that somebody did with a single cam. I mean, it is a well done, you know, really, really cool looking project. That's amazing. Were you already friends with that couple that helped make it happen?
Strangers.
So that's just the best. And again, I mean, just that idea of you had an idea and you took the simple step. I mean, it's still a step of faith. Anytime we like make an idea, a passion, or a dream public, I feel like that is still a step. Mm-hmm. But you posted on Facebook. I mean, you didn't borrow, you know, $1 million. You didn't whatever. You said, I've got something in me. I'm going to float it out there. If you had not gotten much traction, did you think about much beyond the post, so to speak? I mean, if let's say nobody responds, are you like, no, I'm going to do this? Or is it just like, hey, we're going to throw it out and see what God does with it?
I throw arrows at boards all the time.
Yeah.
And no's don't hurt me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are some no's that would hurt me. But typically speaking, I mean, people say no. Okay. Yeah. What's the worst they can say? No. But I mean, you get a yes here and there. And those yeses can be incredible.
See, that by itself is just a great leadership lesson and life lesson, because so many of us are scared of the no. I mean, feelings of failure, feelings of rejection, feelings of I'll never do this. And when you really make peace, I hope I don't mess it up, because you said no's don't. What'd you say? No, I'm not. No's don't scare me. Is it? What did you just say? It was good.
I don't remember what I said.
We'll look it up and we'll make it a quote. But that's just a great way to look at life, because the more you're willing to plant seeds and see what happens, I mean, stuff comes, and the fewer seeds you plant, the fewer plants are going to grow. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, but you have to be okay. I think of Jesus' parable of the seeds and the soil. And even though I don't think he meant it to be this mathematical equation, the reality is 3/4 of the seeds did not end up producing anything. It's one that specifically grew up and then grew to something magnificent. But I oftentimes think, man, I don't think Jesus intended we take it literally, but like, man, if I plant seed and 3/4 of it is the no, am I good to go with that?
Right.
And am I willing to keep planting so I get the one seed that is the 30, 60, 100 times? So I just love that so much that you took action, you took a step, and here you go. So all of this incredible stuff is happening with getting Lucas Project off the ground. And Lucas Project came before some tragedy with your first husband, right? That was already going, or was it not yet?
No, that was after. After we had our daughter, my husband Jason began having all of these health problems. And it was so strange, because he was a gym owner, he was a personal trainer, he was a tennis professional. And the doctors kept saying, you have type 1 diabetes, like totally out of the blue, and you have to get your sugar levels under control. And he was doing everything in his power to get his sugar levels under control, but he had vision loss and disorientation and weight loss. And one night he passed out at home and was rushed to the local ER, and it was discovered that he had a baseball-sized brain tumor. Mm. And so they did immediate surgery, and it wasn't cancerous at that point, so we were given the option to watch and wait. And we were told often these tumors don't return for 20 years, and you can just go home and live your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. And ended up pregnant again, and had my 4 boys and one girl.
Yeah.
And during that pregnancy, the tumor came back, and this time it was a glioblastoma, and the life expectancy for that is 14 months, and Jason passed away 1 month before his son, his infant son, turned 1 year old.
Wow. So what was that relative to the expectancy? They gave you 14 months?
14 months to the day, almost.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Wow.
Yep.
I mean, obviously, I mean, anybody who's hearing this, you just think, how is this even possible? I mean, first to go through everything with Lucas and now losing your first husband. When you're hearing that news, I mean, whether it be the first time when it turned out to be okay and then the second time when it did not, how are you processing that as a wife and as a mom? I mean, are you back to the fighting mode where you're like, we'll get through this, we'll figure it out? Or is it how, why me, God? This isn't fair, or is it some combination of multiple things?
I think the first one, it was serious, but we didn't take it that seriously with the admonishment that often these don't return for 20 years. We were like, all right, you know, we're good. We dealt with all the brain issues with Luke, and we dealt with it with Jason, and we've been tested, and we are going to sail on to our promised land, mm-hmm. which is, you know, why we ended up pregnant again and just going on with life. Jason felt amazing. When it came back so quickly in the middle of my pregnancy, mm-hmm. My go-to emotion was anger. Like, that was the fuel I tapped into for probably 14 months, mm-hmm. like just raging, wailing, wrestling with the Lord. I do not understand why you would call me to this. Like, I am 32 years old. I have 3 children, 1 with profound disabilities, pregnant with a 4th, and a dying husband. Like, great job, Lord. Mm-hmm. And just wailing, lamenting, and honestly would even read about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane often with his lamenting and, Lord, take this, or Father, take this cup from me. And what it boiled down to for me, just like Christ was, but not my will, but yours be done. It, like, literally a week or two before Jason passed away, just on my knees in surrender, you are God and I am not. Mm-hmm. Blessed be your name. I do not understand this, but wow. I will be obedient to what you want me to do.
Were you ever tempted to really, like, walk away from faith or anything like that?
I wasn't. No. No, my faith was so real to me after going through what I went through with Lucas and that pregnancy. Like, Jesus Christ was so real. I even had a vision during that pregnancy of Jesus holding my baby in heaven, like protecting the baby. Mm-hmm. So I knew like, God cared. I knew, like, Jesus was real and his promises were real. It just, I did not understand it. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why I had to walk through so much pain at such a young age with such a young family.
Right. What were the support networks like around you at that time? And we really didn't talk about, when you were talking about what it's like to raise a special needs child, we didn't get into the support that does or does not mm-hmm. exist around you. But now you're a single mom with a special needs child and a bunch of other kids. What is the support network like in the community at that point for you in general and also relative to special needs?
That's an interesting contrast. When Jason was going through cancer, I had more help than I knew what to do with. Like, I did not make a meal for years. I didn't mow my lawn or do my laundry or clean my house. I went to my mailbox every day and there was money or gift cards, or people came into my house and cut my kids' hair. They took my kids back to school shopping. Like, anything and everything that could possibly be done for me was done for me. Mm-hmm. And I contrast that to raising a profoundly disabled young man for 20 years. It's been almost crickets.
Really?
Like, absolutely nothing. And I think in my processing, it's human beings like short-term. That's why we go on short-term missions trips and we take the pictures and we feel good about ourselves. Or, you know, even as small groups, we show up and we help somebody mm-hmm. for a short amount of time. Yeah. But we don't know what to do with that family that's raising this challenging child for 20, 30, 40 years. And then this child becomes a grown man or woman. Mm-hmm. And like, is this family going to expect me to step in and watch this person? Like, there's a lot of fear, I think, and unknown surrounding that. And I would just encourage anybody listening, too, if you know a family like that, there is no expectation that you necessarily step in and provide care mm-hmm. for that child. but provide something like offer.
Give us some examples of what would that look like?
Offer a meal and don't even leave it open-ended because we're so good at just being like, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it needs to be like, I'm bringing you a meal Wednesday night, lasagna or tacos. Yeah. I'll leave it on your front porch so you don't even have to put your makeup on or fix your hair or anything. You don't even have to see anybody. But all those other ideas too, lawn care, laundry, gift cards, haircuts,
mm-hmm.
Offer to help with the typical siblings. That was a huge thing for our family because we were always doing the divide and conquer because we wanted the typical siblings to have all the normal experiences. Mm-hmm. But one of us would always have to stay home with Lucas. So if you can bring those typical siblings to the football game or the roller skating party or whatever, we want our kids to mm-hmm. participate and experience those things. We're just exhausted.
Yeah,
we're trying
right.
to just keep our heads above water.
Right.
So there are a million ways that you can help without necessarily providing that respite.
Yeah, that's really good. I think that, you know, when people have some kind of sickness, I feel like intuitively a lot of people know what the go-tos are.
Mm-hmm.
I think sickness is a lot, at least it seems to me, a lot more common where you see people dealing. I mean, I know so many people who have dealt with cancer or some other thing. And you know, we all, okay, with the meals, this, that. And I just think it's helpful to have those practical ideas. It's funny because there is quite an overlap. When my wife went through breast cancer and she had a bilateral mastectomy, and then after that, the surgery failed. And so we had to go through another round of a major surgery that then involved her back too. And so what was supposed to be a 1-year process became somewhere over 2 years of just,
wow.
you know, between surgeries, and then there's actually a third surgery involved that no need to get into. And then there's, of course, the treatment itself of medications, chemo, radiation, all this stuff. And I love what you said. I mean, people would just do exactly what you said. They would not ask. They would bring stuff over. We had once a small group from church that said, we're just going to come over and clean your house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that taught me two things. Number one, I love that they just said, we're coming. And number two, I did not realize how many things that we had not been cleaning because
right.
when they left and I was like, this place
right.
looks different around here.
Right.
But it was so, I mean, I'm guessing you would probably throw that out in the, you didn't mention cleaning your house, but I'm guessing
yeah.
you put that in the list too.
Absolutely.
It was so practical. It was such a blessing because mm-hmm. it was just like one less thing off one thing off our plates, one less thing to do. And I love like the idea of taking the other kids because you know, everybody's at a different place at their level to wade into situations to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And some are ready to go into the deep end of the pool. And we have deals with this at church all the time because you're always trying to help people take a next step.
Mm-hmm.
And my version of what stretches me is very different than, you know, for some people doing a mission trip in urban Detroit is just mind-blowing. For some, going to Mexico is like, oh my goodness. For some, you know, and going to Turkey, you know, all these are different places on the scale. But I think what you're saying is so cool because I don't know who can't take some kids that don't have special needs to a game and just have
right.
a great time. I mean, that's
or drop them off,
yeah,
and then bring them back home.
Yeah, like, that's a blessing by itself. We're trying right now to this isn't quite the same, honestly, and of course this will be good fodder for thought for our team. But even with foster and adoptive families, again, not the same as what you guys are going through, but there is a lot of need many times associated with those relationships and trying to get a ministry off the ground here at our church where we can give some practical supports to families in a similar fashion. So I think this is a great conversation. I'm curious, you know, you said it sounds like when you're navigating suffering, so you've navigated now having a special needs child, you've lost your husband. When you think about the core disciplines or practices that you leaned into to just sustain in the midst of suffering, on the one hand, I feel like that you're saying that process of lament and grief was crucial. You're not trying to sweep it under the rug. You're not trying to, you know, you're okay with it, like what we see so often in the Psalms in the Bible, being angry with God and just putting it all out there. It sounds like prayer and scripture were a key part of your journey. I'm just curious, for those who are suffering in some way, shape, or form, and there's one thing I know from 24 years of pastoring now, the level of suffering people are going through is incalculable. It's just really, it's sobering. What else would you say to the person right now who's suffering and you're encouraging to their, your encouragement on how to navigate tough times?
You know, I navigated it so differently in both of my experiences with Luke and with Jason. Like I mentioned, like with Lucas, I just so leaned into the shepherd's care. Like Jesus and I were just like tight. Yeah. And I just relied so heavily on his strength and his faithfulness and his mercy and his love, and just poured myself into scripture and listened to praise and music, you know, worship music all day and prayed. And I remember even having a conversation with the Lord, like, I don't know how I'm going to manage this when the baby comes, because I'm not going to have the same amount of time to invest in all of these spiritual disciplines.
Right.
And like the Holy Spirit whispered to me, your work with your child will be your worship.
Mm-hmm.
Like your obedience to what I'm calling you to do will be your worship. And that was such a just a clarification for me, and also just an affirmation, like, okay, so we have this idea of worship as, you know, singing and praising and diving into scripture, but there's also the work, and we don't talk about that as much, and the heart and holiness of that work. And then, you know, with Jason, I was angry. I've been very honest about that. There was a lot of raging and lamenting and not so much scripture reading. There honestly wasn't time. I was literally just trying to survive day by day with four kids and a dying husband. And it was just these prayers of absolute desperation at the end of the day, as I'm in the shower finally at 10 o'clock at night, just, Lord, help, like, just help. And I think both of those responses were appropriate in their time. I've learned, too, that if we don't get that stuff out of us, that suffering, that trauma, it lives in our bodies. So to rage and wail and lament is kind of freeing and healing, really, in releasing some of that.
Yeah. So when you, I think that, so let's go to the first time when you're like, I'm not going to have time, and our work is our worship. I think there are a lot of moms in particular, I would say, but stay-at-home parents in general who are saying, hey, I don't have time to, I mean, it's just like child thing to child thing. Mm-hmm. How do the most spiritual time I have is when I'm going to the bathroom. It's literally, and even then, if somebody's knocking on the door, you know, you're like, please. Yeah. So I guess, you know, it sounds like you had to really look at your day-to-day serving your family as worship. Was just that change of mental framework enough to help you sense a connection and intimacy with God in those kind of moments that did it? I mean, I guess somebody might be thinking right now, like, hey, I'm changing diapers and I'm not feeling a whole lot of spiritual connection right now to God. So that's what I'm trying to get at.
I have a whole story about that.
Yeah.
I really do.
Let's hear it.
That was the biggest game changer for me as a caregiver. Lucas was about 15 or 16 years old, going through that very challenging period. I had my first book contract. I had a deadline. I'm building this nonprofit, talking about creating this documentary, like big, important, ego-boosting things.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucas is homesick, and he is screaming all day, and he has diarrhea, and I've changed like 10 diapers, and I am fed up because I can't get my stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm running around and huffing and puffing and resentful and, you know, whispering horrible things under my breath. And I heard the Holy Spirit say, this is holy work.
Mm.
Serving your son is the holiest work you can do this side of eternity. You are becoming more Christ-like in your act of service towards your son, just like Jesus came to serve and to heal and to wash people's feet. You know, this is what you are meant to do here on earth. All of that lofty stuff is good stuff, mm-hmm. but this is holy work. And it totally changed my perspective from that moment forward, so much so that I had someone create a sign that says, this is holy work, hung it over Lucas's bed. I'm not a very fast learner, and I needed to like see it.
Yeah.
Got it, Lord. I got it. But that from that moment on, it really was a complete shift in my perspective and understanding that we are meant here. We are meant to be on this earth to serve. Mm-hmm. And in our service, we become more Christ-like.
Gosh, that's so good. Yeah, I think that we think of these classic spiritual disciplines, and they're important. I mean, nobody's mm-hmm. going to deny, oh, it's good to be in scripture or pray and these sorts of things. But it is true. I think service is its own spiritual discipline. And I think of now, you're just reminding me of a book I haven't read in a long time, Richard Foster's book. It's called Celebration of Discipline or Spirit of the Disciplines. I can't remember. One's Dallas Willard and one's Richard Foster. But for both of them, they would say serving is in itself a spiritual discipline. This is one of the ways we connect with Jesus and grow into maturity. But there is a sense where you have to be intentional about seeing it as such and saying, God, I'm going to meet you in serving. And even this Sunday, I'll be talking a little bit about Sabbath. And it's funny because Jesus would get into fights all the time with the religious authorities of his day about Sabbath. But it was, when you look at the fights, what they're about, it was always Jesus serving people. When they, you know, they're like, you're not supposed to be helping people today. It's Sabbath.
And, right.
And, you know, I wonder if Jesus was not just like, no, I'm going to help people because it's important, but actually I am connecting with God with the Father, through not just resting and taking Sabbath as we think about it, but through the serving. I love that. Now I think about, you know, you talk about writing books and podcast and the Lucas Project and all these different things. Any sane person right now is going like, how in the world does she do that? I mean, yes, you're type A and you're a driver, but still, I mean, what you've described already as far as having lots of kids and all, I mean, how does this even happen?
When you live in fight or flight, I mean, you stay at this pretty high intensity mode for years and years and years. And Lucas moved into his group home last February, and I hit a complete wall, total burnout, crawled into bed and watched stupid Netflix shows for about 3 months.
Yeah.
My body had just stayed at such a high intensity mode for so many years because of the level of care that Lucas required. And I figured I might as well just stay here and accomplish and create and do this. And then I maybe don't have to deal with my grief or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever I was running from. But this past year, it was like, God was like, it's time for you to rest a bit. And I did. I'm kind of emerging a little bit now mm-hmm. from a pretty intense period of rest and just asking what's next.
Did you know the whole time when you were in the go, 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 stay up here mode, did you consciously know I am choosing to just be in that mode? Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, because it seems like to me, one would just live at that level in such a way that you've been there long enough. It's just how you do life.
It was just how I did life. And it was all amazing things. Like, I mean, I'm getting book contracts and I'm getting patted on the back and sort of building this ego idol even on social media. And people are loving what I'm doing. And so even wrestling and grappling with all of that this past year. It was all great stuff. It was God-ordained stuff, but there was also an element of ego there that had to be crucified and continues to have to be crucified. And
how do you think you'll go into this next season of ministry and leadership different than where you were previously?
That's hard to answer right now because I'm currently navigating what that's going to look like. I will be getting some help with the Lucas Project. It's not all going to be about just Ronnie anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm being much more intentional with my family, my children. We've made some decisions moving forward that will involve me being much more involved. Mm-hmm. And that's good. They need me. Mm-hmm. I've recognized that even with my young adult children, you kind of think they fly the coop and there they go. And that's not how that works at all.
Yeah.
They need a lot and they continue to come home and they want to go for coffee and they want to come for dinner and they want these deep, meaningful talks. And I want to be available for that. So I'm still trying to figure out what that's going to look like, but I think it's going to be a lot slower and simpler, after this publicity campaign for this latest book, which is really intense right now. But
what's the latest book going to be about?
Caregiving with Grit and Grace is okay. the one that was just released.
The one we were just talking about pre-show here.
I'm still in my publicity campaign goes till the end of February, and that's been pretty intense.
Yeah, you do. I mean, even Jesus had times where he was just straight up busy. You know, we like to, I mean, I think sometimes in popular imagination, you just imagine Jesus like, you know, just always in a state of perfect chill. And, you know, he's like just all that. But it's like, no, I mean, he got interrupted. He got busy. It takes the disciples away to, you know, get some peace and quiet. And then all the people show up and he's like, you know, we've got to get back.
He's probably annoyed.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. It's funny as you say the annoyed thing. I was just reading an Acts the other day where Paul is trying to travel and do his ministry. And then he's been followed around by that. There was a very troubled girl who, and it says literally that Paul finally became so annoyed that he stopped and he's like, "All right, I'm gonna help you because I just don't want to deal with it any longer." So, yeah. So, do you think that you'll have going into this next season and with some of those changes in mind? Do you think you'll have a different sense of joy and presence in it? Do you think that will change at all? Just by virtue of being a little bit slower and whatnot, or do you think it'll be kind of the same?
I think so. Yeah. I want to hope that I can rest in that mode.
Yeah.
My personality is a little bit contrary to that mode. So, but I think if I can be intentional and take some things off my plate, which I am actively doing as we speak.
Yeah. Cool. That's good for you. Tell us, I mean, well, I'll tell you what, first, let me ask this because, it's a great kind of, part of your overall story. You ended up getting remarried and it's just so beautiful. So we've got to hit that. We should probably unpack the book a little bit more too, just so people know more what you're going to cover, but let's talk about how you met your current husband. And it's a fun story and people go on your website and actually see, you know, see more of it, but tell us about that.
That is a fun story. So, at Jason's funeral, Jason's mom pulled me aside and said, "I just want you to know I'm praying for your next husband." And I was like, "What? I'm not. What?"
Yeah, and awkward timing.
Right. okay. And she said, "No, I'm serious. You can't do this life with these four young children alone." And it was just the most beautiful gift she could have given me. But I went home and was like, okay, whatever. And then that Halloween night in October, so Jason passed away in August, I got the kids ready to go trick-or-treating. We went to my grandma's house, and I came home, put them to bed, checked my blog that I had kept updated for the past 3 years while Jason was going through treatments. And a stranger from Pennsylvania left a comment on my blog just saying, "I have no idea why I'm reaching out to you, but there's this young widower in Oklahoma. His wife passed away from brain cancer 4 days after Jason died. He has three young children. I just think you could be a source of encouragement to him." And so I found his blog, just left a little comment like, "Hey, I'm praying for you. If you ever want to talk, feel free to reach out." And woke up the next day to this email from this guy. And that led to numerous emails, phone calls. And we were engaged 4 months later.
You knew.
We knew. Yeah. And married within the year. So
wow,
he moved to Michigan. We adopted each other's kids, went on to have the eighth and final baby together.
That is so incredible. So, I mean, that's obviously 4 months. You guys knew that you knew. Did he have any sense of, man, I have got to really wrestle with what I would be marrying into specifically regarding Lucas?
You know, men always ask this.
Is that, well, I mean, it's funny because...
It always comes from men. Like, no, did he know what he was getting into?
You don't think so? Ladies don't. You just think they're like. I mean, why is it? Because we're just scared?
The ladies are like, he fell in love with her. Yeah. Of course.
The dude's like, I might love you, but whoa, I got to think about some things. Well, I know other situations where it would be actually opposite, where the wife. Married into very challenging disability situations.
And people kind of accept that.
Yeah, I guess, but I think in that case, in the one I'm thinking of, she still spent some good time like asking, okay, am I on board for where this is going to lead? And had to really do a journey with God and say, yeah, I'm going to. That's one situation. I think of others that I've heard where somebody even potentially has an illness they know is going to lead to their spouse dying. Sometimes could be very shortly. Sometimes you know, could be get some years, but do we get married?
Right.
And I know, of course, stories where people have said yes, but there's, I think that I would generally say I hear people talking about counting the cost, but it sounds like you guys didn't have much counting going on.
No, and he was just asked that question recently in an interview, and he was like, I fell in love with her, and it was just That's a it. Package deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, blending families is not easy, and we definitely had our challenges in those early years, and primarily using each other, I think, as therapists, mm-hmm. which I would never recommend in a million years. Like, get an actual therapist to work through your grief about another person you mm-hmm. loved. Like, that's not the healthiest way to go about it. But we're going on 14 years, so wow. something worked.
Congratulations. That's Thanks. Really, really cool. When Lucas moved into the group home, what was that like for you? You've spent a significant portion of your years caring for him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can some of your identity not be wrapped up in that relationship? So much time. I'm thinking about what it would feel like when he moves out and then what that's like and just the emotions. What was it like?
It's funny. While we were creating the group home, I was under contract to write Caregiving with Grit and Grace. And so as I'm grieving and processing the fact that I'm going to be releasing my son into the care of other caregivers and I won't be this primary caregiver anymore, it was like God was downloading this love letter to me, which I'm putting onto paper, mm-hmm. which has now kind of become this love letter to all caregivers. And to be completely honest, we brought him there that first night. We went through the routine. We fed him dinner. Gave him his meds, gave him his bath, and he's so routine-oriented. He has level 3 autism, so things have to be like this. Mm. And we brought him to his new bed. My husband created a safety bed in his new group home, very Oh, cool. similar to, we had to fight the state on being able to have this, but they finally approved it. Brought him to his bed, and he just kept getting out and saying, go to the car, go to the car. We had never heard that phrase before.
Huh.
And just obsessive, trying to get out of the door and come home with us. And we were like, no, Luke, this is your new home. You know, we're trying to explain it to him, but he wasn't understanding it. And finally, we just had to walk away at like 10 o'clock at night. And we went home and just held each other and prayed for his safety Wow. and cried all night, just like kept vigil for him. And that first week, it was like somebody died. Mm-hmm. I can only compare it to how I felt when my late husband died. It was just, there was all this space and I didn't know what to do with it. And I would walk past like where we fed Luke and he would smear like food on the walls and we'd get around to cleaning it whenever he would throw his sippy cup that had chocolate milk in it. And there was splatters on the doors and stuff. And it only recently, I think a month or two ago, I finally wiped that food and those chocolate milk splatters off the walls. And like his bed is still up at our house. I can't take myself to like remove his bed mm-hmm. and it's just going to be a process. Like you said, I mean, I've created this whole world around caregiver advocacy. Everything in my life for the past 20 years has, that thread has been Lucas. Mm-hmm. And now there's just a lot of space.
Do you miss him being at home sometimes, even though, you know, it's the right move and all the things, but yeah,
Not so much. We see him weekly.
Okay.
And so I put eyes on him. I know that he's doing well. So his new home is his new normal. Like mm-hmm. Luke doesn't transition well. And so even when we bring him home to have a meal with us, he finally will now come into our house and eat a meal. But then he gets up, he starts knocking on the door, go to my house, go to my house. Like, okay, yeah. I ate with you and now yeah. I have to go back to my house. That's yeah. like just what he does in his brain.
Yeah. He's got a new normal.
Yes, this yeah. is my new normal. Bring me back to my house. And to see him doing so well is what gives me peace. Yeah. So he's come such a long way now living in this home. He's become so much more independent. If he were struggling, that would be very, very difficult. Yeah. But I see too all the opportunities his siblings have now, like, and Ryan and I have now. And I understood saying yes to being Lucas's primary caregiver for the rest of his life would be a no to so many other aspects of my life. Mm-hmm. So there's breathing room finally. And I think we're all feeling that as a family.
Yeah. That's really cool. It's going to be really, really fun to see how this next season and you guys' journey plays out with regard to, I mean,
yeah,
you've
maybe
gone
we'll
through.
Just run away to Italy. Yeah. Buy a villa and sit by the sea.
Well, it's wild because our kids are just, you know, we have two, one that's off and married and doing his
thing. Yeah, you just had another one get married.
A second one just got married and a third one that's a senior in high school and will go to college as a freshman. And so I think of the emotions we're feeling of some newfound ability to do some things and have some mm-hmm. freedoms that we're not worried about some, you know, who's going to stay with Evan or whatever. And I like multiply that times a million thinking about what it would be like just thinking, whoa, I mean, you just have a whole different set of menu options for life and for your family. It's really cool. When talk about the book for a second, both it's kind of its main message, but also when you think about maybe we could vision cast not just its primary audience who would pick it up, but for others who might say, oh, I could pick it up and give it to someone, that kind of thing. So just spend some time on the book.
Yeah, the book really, my husband said to me for years, you should write a book, like a devotional for caregivers. And I was like, I don't think I'm the person to do that. Remember, I get really angry at God. Like, I'm not like this, you know, you have like these ideas in your head of who maybe that would, who the author of a book like that should be. And it wasn't me. But my agent convinced me to create a proposal and we sent it off and they loved it and picked it up. So, and now I see too God's hand at work. And like I mentioned, as we're creating Hope Farm, I'm writing this book and processing and grieving. And it's just stories about my caregiving journey and how the Lord has spoken to me. And like the story I shared with you about reframing my perspective and mm-hmm. seeing caregiving as holy work is one of the stories in the book. And it's just all of these little tidbits of how God has shown himself faithful. And it's for caregivers in all capacities. Any caregiver in any capacity, I really believe, would receive a lot from this book, even mothers of small children or older children. I've had quite a few mothers say it really resonated with me, you know, special ed teachers or physical therapists or the bus aide.
I think of folks who are in that more of their senior years, and in some cases, aging is a crazy thing. Now, sometimes there's enough age difference that you have one spouse that's just ahead of the curve and is showing it, and so the younger spouse is in a lot of caregiving mode. But sometimes it just, in God's plan, the way it works is you have one person who is going through major health debilitation and one who's vibrant, healthy, could do anything. It's just like, you know, the person hardly aged. I mean, they're out and active.
Right.
But they're now in a role where they're caregiving a lot and their options for life are significantly limited, not because of their own health challenges, but because their spouses, it sounds like, would probably encourage them as well in that capacity.
Aging parents. Yeah. Like ill spouses, like you're saying, special needs children, any caregiver capacity really is who this book is directed towards.
Yeah. And I'm sure your agent said this and you know it as well, but your spirit of authenticity and realness about the beautiful moments where God gives you a revelation of how he's meeting you and the work is worship. You know, those are really encouraging moments, but also I'm guessing you're quite candid about some of the shout out to heaven kind of moments as well. And I think that's good. I think it's going to give people really permission to recognize that. Whenever I have a conversation with someone who is in a significant caregiving role, I would say they usually recognize this is a privilege and this is a calling from God, and they acknowledge that. But they also have days where it's just really, really tough. And I think to be able to have somebody else who you feel like even through a book you're empathizing with is a really cool thing. I think it's going to be a gift to a lot of people. So that's really, really cool. I'm excited for that. Anything else you want to share today, Jess, that just is on your heart that you'd like to have our listeners be able to process a little bit?
Well, if you're in West Michigan, we're hosting a caregivers conference this April through the Lucas Project.
Okay, cool.
So if you are a caregiver, we would love to have you join us, and you can get all that information at thelucasproject.org.
Okay.
We have a bunch of new programs and initiatives going on at the Lucas Project. We're creating another documentary called Uncertaindoc.com, exploring the housing crisis among special needs families here in America.
Wow.
We started production for that. And
that's really exciting. That's it. That's going to be that's a whole different
that's
cut
a whole,
on.
Yeah. Yeah. That is greatly needed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, other than that, just if you know somebody who's in a caregiver role, just reach out and offer some sort of tangible action mm-hmm. of help. Like we were talking about, I think, you know, the meals or taking their kids back to school shopping. Somebody did that for me too.
Yeah.
Just, you know, anything that you, any way you can use your gifts to like just really reach in and offer some hope and encouragement. Mm-hmm. It's always greatly appreciated.
If you have somebody show up and drop off like gift cards, it's not, see, I think sometimes we feel bad because it's like, oh man, it's not as personal. But if somebody shows up and gives like $100 DoorDash, are you like, all right, baby.
Right, right. You don't care that it's not personal.
Yeah. Like, we don't have to cook tonight.
Right. And it's not another casserole.
Yeah. Like, right.
Yeah.
So it just, again, I just so appreciate your willingness to say, because I think sometimes, and we have this with a variety of ministries locally here, there is a spectrum from everything from that show up once, knock something out, it's very accessible, to things that are more relational and more ongoing. And I would say the more relational and the more ongoing, the harder it is to find people who are willing to engage.
Yeah.
And so we pray and hope that changes. And part of where we give opportunities to just try something out is because we hope that through that experience, God might capture someone's heart in such a way that they might be desirous of saying, I want to press into something that's more ongoing. I'm willing to take a risk and be a bit more relational. But I just appreciate you giving us permission to start where we are and not feel like I've got to go straight to the deep end if I'm going to be a help or if I'm going to be a good Christian person. That's it's okay to start where you are, do what you can, and God will use that. So that's fantastic. You've already kind of mentioned this, but yeah, if people want to follow you, find out more about you, what are all the places they can go? Yeah,
I am at jessronnie.com, thelucasproject.org, caregiverdoc.com, the new documentary is uncertaindoc.com. I'm on Facebook. Where am I on Facebook? Jess Ronnie Official and The Lucas Project. Instagram, Jess plus the Mess.
Okay, cool.
All the places.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out today and just sharing your story. I really do appreciate the beauty of you inviting Jesus all the way through and knowing that he's with you in the times that you're crying out in anger and knowing he's with you in the times that you're advancing some next dream project that you're going after. So thanks for being a great example of what it means, not just to step into care for needs, but also just being a leader. I just so love and appreciate that your fundamental wiring is not to just sit there and either feel bad all the time or just say, this is my, God has used you to still do things that are just beyond your circumstances. Obviously, we don't want to put your level of production on everybody and say, this is what everybody should be doing, is writing books and doing all this stuff. But I think it's fair to say for everybody to be asking the question, hey, God, how do you want to use me? Is there something in me that even in a counterintuitive time of life, is there some way that you could do something through me? And I just love how you've stepped up and stepped into those places. And clearly God continues to just have his hand on those things. And I know the next season is going to be incredible as you, I feel like we'll be leading and living out of a different level of
like I said, you can
presence
find me in Italy.
Yeah, that's right. So if that we'll put that on your, in the show notes.
Find me in Italy.
Also find her in Italy if you want a one-on-one. So anyway, thanks for being with us today,
yeah,
Jess. Appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jess today. And for me, there were two big takeaways. Number one, if you know someone who is in a demanding caregiving role, try to do something to just encourage them, help them, give them a break. But Jess gave us all kinds of great examples. And I think anyone listening right now could probably identify something that you could do, a step you could take. So that's number one takeaway for me. And the second takeaway was just, again, encouragement on what it means to advance. That's the namesake of this podcast, Made to Advance. And as you picked up with Jess, she's always thinking about how she can help make something better. Where's there a problem that needs to be solved? And then is about taking a step in that direction. And can you imagine just posting something on Facebook asking, hey, is anybody interested in doing anything like this? And then you end up with a filmmaking team that creates a major documentary. Amazing. Whatever God's put in your heart, don't get paralyzed by it's got to be this huge thing. Don't be paralyzed by it's got to be this massive step. Sometimes the beginning of that big thing is just taking a first step, and the first step may not even be that big of a step, but the key thing is to take it. Well, if you were encouraged by our conversation today, I really want to ask if you would rate and review our podcast. It really does bring encouragement to our team, and it also helps the word get out in greater ways about Made to Advance. This has been a production of Engedi Church, and we have more incredible conversations on the way. And so until next time, just know you were made to advance.